You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McColl, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 509 of the Colombia Calling podcast. This week's very special guest is none other than sociologist Sara Tufano, Italo-Colombian, and has a very interesting story to tell, but not least to promote her book, Colombia, Una herida que no cierra. So let's say a Colombia, a wound that doesn't close. Now, Sara is, well, she speaks to us before she's left for Sao Paulo to do her doctorate, but she has an interesting upbringing, an interesting story, and I'll give you a little bit of a hint. She was at a private school in Bogota before then going to a public school outside of Bogota before going to the Universidad Nacional and becoming a member of the Partido Clandestino Colombiano Comunista and then into the FARC itself. So let's say a privately educated student going into the FARC guerrillas and now dedicating her life to academia and writing for El Tiempo and obviously other things. I know that for a fact that she wants to write a book about her experiences, but it's great to, actually put it into context with someone of this academic stature and having been in the guerrillas themselves and having seen both sides from private school to public schools. And it's an open and flowing conversation. And Tufano's book does obviously take in, as it specifies, the peace accords of the 1980s, from which I believe that negotiators have learned a lot and also at the same time, execute a lot of the same errors over time. So we'll be discussing this as well. And of course, about her time in the guerrillas and other things of interest. Thank you again to Emily Hart, who will be here with the news, the Colombia briefing just very shortly. And I know that she's putting together for next week an episode about the sort of like crypto money, Bitcoin subject here in Colombia. And that will be coming out next week. Last week was a great show as well for International Women's Day. That foundation, Mi Barrio, Mi Sueño, is an excellent one, teaching boxing and empowering women in the barrios, in this particular, the Barrio La Onda in Medellin. And prior to that, of course, thank you to Zach Meese, who was, of course, sharing his information about how to make the move to Colombia and then Medellin a success story, a native Ohioan. Now they're working in nearshoring for a company in Medellin, Colombia. So some good news stories there as well. But I won't natter on. We've got great interviewees lined up for the next few weeks. Of course, nominate and put us in touch with anyone you would like to hear from. That's always the name of the game here. And support us, if you can, on Patreon. That's www.patreon.com/Colombia Calling. All sorts of goodies there on the Patreon page for supporters of the Colombia Calling podcast. And now we'll go over to Emily Hart with the Colombia briefing. Don't go away.
The Colombia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
I'm Emily Hart, and these are your headlines for this week. Thousands of people took to the streets last Wednesday to protest Gustavo Petro's government and its reforms. Right-wing politicians led the protest, including the Centro Democrático party's Paloma Valencia in Bogotá and María Fernanda Cabal in Medellín. The police reported that by midday, more than 50,000 people had taken part across the country and that marches were overwhelmingly peaceful. The president responded to protests by saying, "There will always be people with privileges who do not want to lose them, but the volcanic forces of Colombian society want transformation." The march was also marked by pro-Israel messaging, including numerous demonstrators carrying Israeli flags, some protesting Petro's criticism of Israel's perpetration of genocide in Gaza. 2 days later, to mark International Women's Day, people across the world took to the streets to protest ongoing inequality and violence against women. In Bogotá, however, the riot police ended the demonstration by firing tear gas and stun guns at demonstrators. Both Petro and Francia Márquez spoke out against the excessive use of force, which is now under investigation, according to the Ministry of Defense. Mayor of Bogotá, Carlos Galán, also called for investigation and pointed out that reports of property damage do not constitute justification for police aggression. Protesters in Colombia marched with a range of demands, including effective policies against femicide and rape, the legalization of abortion, and equality in the workplace and home. The president gave a speech asking for forgiveness for the ongoing crisis of femicide in Colombia, i.e. the murder of women and girls, on the basis of gender. The public prosecutor's office has registered 32 femicides already this year, along with 2,000 cases of sexual violence against women and over 12,300 cases of domestic violence against women. These are only the cases which reach the justice system and are likely to be a small percentage of the full number. Women make up over 80% of victims of sexual violence in the country and more than 70% of the victims of domestic violence. The National Statistics Agency also released figures this week showing that women in Colombia spend 4.5 more hours per day on domestic labour than men. Women spend on average 7 hours and 44 minutes per day on unpaid domestic work, according to the new survey. The high-profile femicide of Medellin DJ Valentina Tres Palacios has remained in the headlines this week as her boyfriend John Pulos, a US citizen, is currently on trial in Bogotá for the murder. This week on the stand, he claimed that due to drug consumption, he did not remember whether or not he had suffocated Tres Palacios, but upon waking up next to her body, feared he would not get a fair trial in Colombia, which is why he put her body in his luggage and tried to hide it before fleeing the country. Both Pulos's ex-wife and Tres Palacios's mother have testified that he was an obsessive, controlling, and abusive partner. Salvatore Mancuso, former commander of the now-defunct Autodefensas Unidas de Colombia, the country's largest paramilitary group, was granted release on probation by a Bogotá judge upon his return from the US, where he had served 16 years for drug trafficking. He will, however, remain in prison for now as he still faces more than 40 arrest warrants and pretrial detention requests, which he is waiting for judges to lift before he can go free. Mancuso is accused of more than 60,000 criminal acts between those he committed directly and those for which he is responsible as a former paramilitary commander. He directly led 139 massacres in which 800 people were killed, in addition to other crimes such as displacement, kidnappings, disappearances, drug trafficking, and extortion. Mancuso is one of the highest-profile warlords in Colombian history, and his contributions to historical truth are deemed invaluable, especially as the country has been deprived of them for more than a decade since his extradition to the US. The Transitional Justice Court, the JEP, has accepted his contributions regarding the close relations between paramilitaries and the army. I come to put myself at the service of a peace agenda that will prevent Colombia from being an eternal factory of victims and collective pain, Mancuso said in a letter published the day he landed in Colombia. His evidence on institutions and individuals who collaborated with paramilitaries during the civil conflict is, however, likely to be controversial, as he has claimed links with many on the political right, most notably former President Álvaro Uribe. He has accused Uribe of responsibility for at least one massacre and linked him to various murders. He also alleges that the military gave him lists of civilians to kill and has accused several of the country's most important companies of financing paramilitaries. In peace process news, in San José del Guaviare, a fourth round of negotiations between the government and the Estado Mayor Central, a FARC dissident group, has come to an end. The ceasefire was evaluated and routes for progress mapped out in collaboration with local farmer, ethnic and trade union organizations. In Buenaventura, meanwhile, Los Espartanos, one of the city's two major criminal groups, has abandoned the peace process, alleging unacceptable delays and accusing the other major criminal group, Los Xotas, of failures to comply with truce agreements, including forming alliances with guerrilla group the Ejército de Liberación Nacional, the ELN. Nonetheless, Los Espartanos say that they will continue to comply with the three-month truce agreed to last week. This is the greatest crisis yet for this pilot urban peace process, and the truce had significantly reduced violence in the city. Colombia is yet again the deadliest country in the Americas for human rights defenders, according to a new report by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which verified 126 murders in the region, 70 of which were perpetrated in Colombia. The report concludes that the country's four most violent departments are in the southwest, where a combination of coca cultivation and armed group occupation has fed violence for decades. The departments are El Cauca, Putumayo, Nariño, and Valle del Cauca. Until August, a novel written by Gabriel García Márquez, Colombia's Nobel Prize winner for literature, has been posthumously published this week, his sons having gone against his explicit instructions that it be destroyed. The novel was written in late life when the author was suffering from dementia, reportedly why he lost faith in the book, saying, "The book doesn't work, it must be destroyed." The novel tells the story of a woman who makes a yearly pilgrimage to her mother's grave on a Caribbean island, a trip which becomes marked by a series of sexual encounters. In its first weeks, it has been ranked in the top 10 bestsellers list in Colombia, as well as being simultaneously published in English, translated by Anne McLean. Those were your top stories for this week. Thanks for listening.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I am Richard McColl, your host here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And I'm thrilled to be able to introduce to you a very special guest this week. Every week it's a special guest, but a very special guest because we've been chatting since last year about getting together, about recording this, and we've managed to get her before she leaves to Sao Paulo to study her doctorate. Her name, Sara Tufano. She's Italo-Colombian, so half Italian, half Colombian. And she has a fascinating story of upbringing from the age of 10. In Colombia. She was obviously born in Italy, raised until the age of 10. She's just brought out a book, in Colombia called Colombia, una herida que no cierra, los procesos de paz de los años 80. So it deals with the different peace processes in the 1980s. Now, this book is an excellent book in Spanish. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see it there. It's dense. It's full of information. But before we get into that, Sara, thank you so much for your time and agreeing to share some of your story here on the Colombia Calling podcast.
Hi, Richard. It's really nice to meet you, and I'm really happy to be here in your podcast.
No, the pleasure is mine, and the pleasure is that of my listeners. And, we've been going for hundreds of episodes now,
And to me, it's always important to get different academic voices on the podcast to discuss not only their backgrounds, but what is going on in Colombia. And I think, as you are a sociologist, Italo-Colombiana, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your upbringing, because there are some twists and turns there that are so interesting. But perhaps you could give us a brief background.
Yes, of course, because my upbringing clearly explains some of the choices I made in my life. And as I told you, I was born in Italy, and because my father is Italian, my mother is Colombian. And when I was 10 years old, we moved to Colombia, we came here, and we started living in Bogota. And because we didn't speak Spanish yet, we understood Spanish because my mother used to speak to us in Spanish. So we went to the Italian school, Leonardo da Vinci, Colegio Italiano mm-hmm. Leonardo da Vinci. And we stayed there for like a year. And that's how, in a certain way, I met Colombian society, because my classmates at the time were like middle class, high class children. And so I had some of my classmates were children, the daughter of the son of some ambassador in Bogota. And that was my socialization, primary socialization, which is the like one of the main the way, in a certain way, how you understand the world when you're a child. And we stayed there for like a year. And then my parents decided that they wanted to live in the countryside. So we went to Tabio, which is a town like 2 hours from Bogota. And because in Italy, you know, like, well, in Europe, public education is very good. Yeah. There's not like a huge difference between public education and private education as in Colombia or Latin America. So they thought that it was a very good idea that we studied in the public school here in Pavia. So I started studying like with the children of peasants, because that was 3 years ago. So this is like very, well, not like countryside, like not very, how do you say, well, it's really close to Bogota. It's not that far. Yeah. It's not Guainía, Guaviare, no? it's still Cundinamarca. But we had like, it was like a very different experience from what we had in Bogota. So, and in the weekend, because during the week I went to the public school, and then in the weekend I used to play and to meet some of my friends who were themselves middle class children. That they, that like, my parents decided that we studied here in Tabio, and the parents of my parents' friends decided that it was a good idea that they went to Bogota to study. So I had like, that's how I met like the unequal Colombian society. That's how, well, you know, as a child, you don't understand that intellectually. It's more like a feeling. It's an experience that stayed with me until, well, many years after that, I started to understand why it was that way. And why there was like this huge split between classes and this huge difference. Yes, between classes and also in relationship to education.
It's
It's an incredibly difficult thing to imagine, isn't it? You're in a public school in, well, the near countryside to Bogota, but with farmers' children and humble people, and yet your social life at the weekend is probably at the Italian club, as they say, in the middle class. And so this was a very formative experience leading you to, I don't know, when was it that you said, this cannot continue?
Well, I want to say something, and as I grew up and I started understanding that it was me who had this upbringing, like, and my friends didn't have it. So it's not that I knew more than they did, it's just that I understood that I had like a different upbringing, and that was one of the reasons why I made some choices. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, I could have made no choices at all, and because it's a mix of things. It's not just your socialization; it's also other things. And in my case, I went to other schools, but always in Tabio. And then the last 2 years, I decided that I wanted to validation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And well, there's some validation institutes in Bogota, and I decided to go. I wanted, because I had been in like in so many schools, I wanted to finish my high school like very fast. And then I had the opportunity to go to Canada to learn English. I stayed there. I did grade 12. I stayed there for like a year. And when I was in Canada, I started my activist life in a way, because it was the moment of anti-globalization protests in Seattle, but that was before in Quebec. And what was very interesting is that I was in Canada and in the United States, traveling and meeting all these activists. And some of them would ask me like, so how is the, what about the armed conflict in Colombia? What do you know about it? And what do you think about guerrillas and the FARC and ELN? And I didn't know anything. I was like 16, 17 years old. So that I understood that like in high school, in both public schools and private schools, like Colombian history, like they don't tell you everything, you know. It's like I started to feel that there was like a huge part of Colombian history that I didn't know about, or about the social conflict. So middle class and high class people, usually they get to know the conflict through media, through television, through newspapers. And so I started to think about it, and it was like a movie Inception. I had like the idea. And when I came back, I was like, no, I think I want to study sociology. I want to go to the National University, Universidad Nacional, because I thought that it would be very helpful for me to understand why there was like this conflict so long. Why had been so long? How did it start? And all those questions that you had when you are like 20 years old and you want to study sociology.
Mm-hmm. So. Did you go to the Universidad Nacional then?
Yes, but just 3 semesters, so it's something that I don't tell anybody. it's something that I don't write on my CV, because it was just like 3 semesters, and that was where the people from the FARC were the thing that I, then what I write in the introduction. And from the communist clandestine party. It's like, you know, the public university is like a place where they recruit people for their parties and movements.
So you did 3 semesters there, and were you know, obviously, what year was this?
So we are talking that's something also very interesting. It's that it was the Álvaro Uribe's first government. So we're talking about 2002.
Yeah.
That's when I started university. And I remember one of the teachers in one class, it was like Introduction to Sociology, I think. She was talking about the end of the Caguan's peace process with Pastrana, and how that would start like a war again, and it was so bad for the country, and that we had to think about it, and about, and she started talking about the importance of peace. And I think that was like the only contact with what was happening in the country, because the rest was studying Marx, Weber, Durkheim, like the classics of sociology. And some of my classmates and I, we were like, because, you know, the sociology department in the National University was founded by Fals Borda, mm-hmm. the famous sociologist, and Camilo Torres, mm-hmm. the priest that decided that wanted to go to be a guerrilla member. So we had like this story about the origins of the discipline, and like it was very different from what we were living at that time. It was also the Uribe's, the start of his government, the beginning of his government. And so many things were changing about how people were thinking about the armed conflict and the terrorism, the war, on terrorism. And so all the things, in a way, like I started to think about it, and that's how I thought that I wanted to militate, to be in a party, and that's how I met the Colombian Communist Party.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so you joined the Partido Comunista Clandestina Colombiana, so the PCC. Okay. And this is I think it's a political wing, like a legitimate political wing of the FARC.
Yes, it was because some Colombian history is that we all know that the guerrilla in the world, they have like a political wing, as you say, like a party. And for many years, the FARC had like a close relationship with the Communist Party. Mm-hmm. But in the 90s, with the end of the Cold War and all those changes and the fall of the Soviet Union, the Communist Party decided to split with the FARC. There was like so many groups started saying that, you know, the armed struggle was not useful anymore, and was the end of that time, no? Because we all know that the 60s and 70s, there were so many guerrillas in the world, not just in Colombia. And so in a way, they broke in that relationship with the FARC. So the FARC decided to create their own party. Mm-hmm. And it was clandestine, of course, because the far were a terrorist organization, and but it was more like political. It was a way to study Colombian history and mm-hmm. to start to have to understand the story of the FARC. And it was a first approximation to the political history, Colombian political history. And yes?
No, go on, please.
No, then of course, because the FARC was a peasant organization, they needed people from the city to give to help to educate, even in some basic things like teaching to read something, but also like in a political way, because there's always this idea that the FARC are like an armed and political organization, so they have they had like in the mountains on weekends, they had like these party meetings where they would have political lessons in a way during the war, in the middle of the war. So they like once you had like some once you had been like some you had been maybe some months in the party, they ask you like, do you want to go at like meet go to the mountains and meet this other part of like the armed guerrilla? And some of us would say yes and other would say no. And in my case, of course, I wanted to understand, I wanted to see by myself what was happening in the mountains.
Mm. So you went up. I mean, after a while, you went up to see. And is this the way? But from what I understand, you remained a political activist. But in your introduction in the book, I mean, you do say you were a member of the FARC.
Yes. Well, I don't say a member. I said I stayed in a.
Oh yeah.
Well, informal, because I was telling you informal. In a formal way, I was still a member of the party. But once you are in the middle of the war, once you are with them and you end up like doing the things that they do, and they teach you, and actually at the time was surviving the war because it was the Plan Patriota, which the Plan Patriota, that was before, because Plan Patriota started in Cundinamarca.
Yeah.
It was a plan they wanted to kill the main commanders. Mm. And they started doing that in Cundinamarca, and then they went to Meta and other departments. And that was the moment that I was there. So it was like, just surviving the war.
Mm. Yeah, the quote I found it here is "Viví algunos de los peores momentos del Plan Patriota, la campaña militar más grande contra las FARC-EP lanzada por el gobierno de Álvaro Uribe, y aún en ese contexto nunca aguantamos hambre." And there you are. So, but then, I mean, what can I say? What was the year that you left then? Because you went to university. You left to go to university in Paris.
Yes. No, then I stayed there for some years. And this is an experience I would like to write. And I would like to write in another moment, because because, as I say in the introduction, I've talked to some people about my experience, and some of them told me like, you shouldn't tell your story. Well, first, because of security issues, and also because they said like you didn't become like a commander, you were not like an important figure. And for some years I used to think, I thought about it, and then I said, well, I think this is an experience. I'm not saying that it's a very, I'm not comparing to other experiences, but it's a way to talk about the conflict. It's a way to tell the conflict. It's this standpoint from a woman, a middle class woman, which is not like the majority of the FARC, and also a woman that, you know, I couldn't go out. Because in the moment that they asked me, like, do you want to stay here for the rest of your life? Basically, after some years, the commander asked me, like, do you want to stay here? And I said, no, because I knew what was living in the mountains during the war. And I thought that maybe I could help in other ways. And I wanted to study and I wanted to go back to university. So I said no, and I left. And they said, and they told me, like, okay, you can leave, and now you can restart your life, and in the future we will see again. It was something like that. And
I'm just going to interrupt. It's an incredible contrast with an interview I had a few weeks ago with an author, from an upper class Bogotana family who had to leave because I think it was the M19 was going to kidnap her brother. They kidnapped her brother for 6 months, and she had to leave. But she has done an investigation that's run for more than 12 or 14 years into the life of a young girl from Putumayo who went into the FARC, but was largely used as a sex slave when she was very young, and, you know, the commander's girl and so on. And I find it just really fascinating, these different levels.
Yes.
You know, within the FARC itself. And this is something that's very much coming to light as we talk about the Jurisdicción Especial para la Paz and everything else. And I can't remember one of the top ranking female women FARC members who's in Congress, and I can't remember her name. I was talking to her, and she's, you know, she was saying that women never get to the very top. This has to be someone who's educated, such as yourself. You have to see the limitations as well.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And also, it's not that my dream wasn't being a commander. So I was like, oh, I want to be. But I knew that it was going to be very difficult. And it's the thing is that, you know, being a commander, like, it could be like so many years, and you could die any moment. Because I almost died myself. And I was almost killed, so I also survived. And what you're saying, yes, I had, because it, like, my experience would sound like a cliche in a way. It's like this romantic view of the farm, but it's not that at all, because I know that the FARC kidnapped it, that there were so many victims. I'm very conscious about it. But of course, I also believed in other things, and that's why I went. Because if I had only the vision of the guerrilla are the worst thing in the country and in the world, I wouldn't be there. And another thing that I wanted to say, it's when you are in the mountains, you don't know anything about what is going on around you. You know, like what the commanders say, you know, that, and because it was like a huge army, And I was in the Oriental block, Block Oriental. And I was like in a very small unit. Like, I didn't know, you know, some meters away, there could be like more guerrilla. And I didn't know that because this is very clandestine. Like, you don't know what it's going on around you. So what happened in Havana, in Cuba, when the FARC commanders met the some victims of the conflict was really a turning point, because some of us understood like the pain and what had happened to other people, you know? So it's very I mean, what I'm saying is that either like propaganda, it's both the democratic security narrative, which says that guerrilla is the worst, like the main problem in Colombia are the guerrillas, that, and we know that it's not like that, and also the guerrilla propaganda, which says that they didn't want anything wrong and they were only victims also of some social conditions. Like both narratives are wrong. So in a way, I could see why the guerrilla was very appealing for some people, but I could also see why like they had no future, because there were so many things that were wrong.
I have a few more questions about your time in the guerrilla, and then we'll get on to some of the context of the book, because I think it's so fascinating as well. When you got, let's say, you joined the Partido Comunista Clandestina Colombiana, so the clandestine Communist Party of Colombia, would you say you were young and impressionable? It was easy for them to almost draw you in. Would you say that it was more of a condition of your age that they were able to sort of, or you were genuinely politically driven to become part of the PSSC?
Well, this is something that I've been thinking about, because of course now I think I wouldn't go the guerrilla. Of course, it's something that is related to your age, something that you do when you're young. But life itself is this way. Like, you understand first intellectually, and then you have the experience. It's when, at that age, for example, while I was in the guerrilla at that age, like 24, my mother got pregnant. So she intellectually knows what it's been a mother, how it's going to be like, but you don't have the experience. So intellectually, I knew the Colombian history. I knew that this like was disgusting, an equal society, the Colombian society. I knew that I wanted to do something to fix that. I wanted to be with other people that thought the same way as I did. And I thought that, you know, like middle-class people were not doing anything. And I was very curious also. I wanted to know like what was happening in the mountains and why it was different from what was streaming on television. And I knew all that in my head, but, you know, I didn't have the experience. So for example, you know, armed conflict or war, like, most of us talked about the Colombian war, but, you know, we don't have the experience of what it's been to be like, to be under attack, for example, in the mountains or other things related to war.
Now, you mentioned at one point that you were up there for several years and you almost died. You were almost killed. Can you tell us a bit about that experience?
Well, yes. As I told you, it was like an intense period of war because it was the Plan Patriota. And what happened, because after what happened in the Caguán's peace process, is that the guerrilla stopped being like a mobile guerrilla because the, how do you say, like the main characteristic of guerrilla is that they move all the time, right? Mm-hmm. So, and they have an advantage that the army, the like the official army, don't have, and it's that they know the place where they are, like they know the mountains and they know the people, and that's the strength of a guerrilla. Mm-hmm. So what happened also with the paramilitaries and the counter guerrilla that the army created was that the army started going to the places where the guerrilla was. Mm-hmm. You know? So they started to, in a certain way, to occupy their territories. And so the guerrilla had to go like almost in the jungles where no connection at all with the population and people that could help them. And so they had to move all the time. And in the Taiwan's peace process, they stopped moving because they had like this huge area, zona de extensión, that was for them, and they could stay there, and they just started to live like a normal life. Mm-hmm. So when that process broke, they went to their life they had like in the 80s and in the 70s when they started to grow. And it was like moving all the time. You couldn't stay like a night or two nights because, and also there's also the aviation, l'aviation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the aviation.
Like the aviation, the, like
they,
that was
they were
something
bombing
that
you.
The army. Yes, and they didn't do that before. Mm-hmm. So you start moving all the time, and there's a moment that you don't have fear anymore. You're not like, because you are so used to hear the bombings and the shots and everything, and it was I was wounded twice. Like the first time was like at the very beginning, so I don't know why they sent me like to the La Cortina. It's like the main when there's like a combat, so you have
like
the army.
Yeah.
Yes, they sent me like to the front, and I didn't have weapons, so I don't know why I was there, and so one of the guerrilla had like a mortero, and it exploded, and one of the I was wounded like in how do you say pulmon,
lung, in your lung,
in my lung, yes.
Well, that's so, really dangerous.
Yes, I could have died, but they had like the people. Well, they have doctors, and also they have enfermeros, like very good ones. But they are so used to operate and to in the jungle, and so I was able. They were able to. Well, that it's they put like a two thorax. Inside,
into your thorax. So this,
into, yes, and well,
So that was the one experience.
Like that was the one, and that, and all this while they were like bombing all the time. So it was a very strong experience. And the second one was just an ambush, and I was wounded in the arm, but the shot like didn't get the bone, just the flesh, so it wasn't that.
You must suffer post-traumatic stress syndrome. You must.
Yes, I did. Yeah. Yeah. I did. Yeah. Well, most of the people that go through those experiences, the soldiers that go to war, experience that in a way.
Definitely. Yes. I think we could talk, and I could listen to your tales and your stories from the Monte and the Bloque Oriental. Who was in charge of the Bloque Oriental at that time?
Well, at that time it was Jorge Briceño,
Mono Jorge. Mono Jorge, that's what I thought. But I think I could listen to these for hours, and I know, but you know, I do want to talk a bit about your book, and also you are going to write your memoirs. You are going to write about your experiences, and so I will read those, and we'll have you back on to talk about that again. But I think I want to talk about your book, Colombia, una herida que no cierra, because it's very academic, and you go through all the different peace processes in the 1980s, and you know, I know a fair bit, but not into the minutia that you have gone, because I know you did this as your master's thesis at the Universidad de Sao Paulo in Brazil. But there are things that really jump out to me as someone who sort of studies language and writes, and it's the way that you really clarify terminologies. How, you know, there was guerrilla and then it was narco guerrilla or narco paramilitary, or I found another one as well, the different phases of the government, the paramilitaries and the guerrillas. And these are the things that really got to me. And you've kind of touched on it a bit earlier when you were talking about sort of the end of the Cold War and then the terminology changes and the way that, let's say, you know, a group such as the FARC is then seen. But I have to ask, because everyone will ask, the FARC started out, you know, as farmers, wishing for land. And again, very basic, very brutish to say that. But then, of course, marginalized, stigmatized, they get involved in everything else. But they, you know, the FARC has been involved in coca production, right? I mean, it's when they say, no, we only taxed coca growers, the FARC was involved. Of course it was, right?
Yes, but in the 80s was not.
No. This is why the terminology goes along hand with it.
Yes. Yes. Mm. What I discovered, because I didn't know it, because of course I was studying that and I was learning as well. Mm. Is that they started, like, in order to attack those peace processes, because there are so many people interested in not making peace, is that was one of the main ways to attack the peace process. It was saying that they were narco guerrilla and terrorists in a moment when they were not. They were not in the business. I'm not saying that they would go in the business before that. And of course, some of the regions, because in my case, like I cannot say that I saw something related to narcotráfico in the guerrilla, but of course in the south. Well, we know there are some regions and everything, so it depends of so many things. But in the moment, in the 80s, they were not. It was just they had like this relationship with the coca productions through the Gramaje.
Yeah.
Gramaje, which was like a tax.
A tax on the coca harvested, then made into paste and so on. But let's go into, because most, I'd say a huge amount of my listeners aren't going to know so much about the peace accords of the 1980s. And I think what's so revealing is the quantity of guerrilla groups that there were. It's almost shocking, which goes to show the unrest and the unsettled nature of Colombia at the time. I mean, when you think of all the different groups and revolutionary groups and the Quintinlame and everything else, it just goes to show. And so you go through each one and through each different president. And I think the one that caught my eye the most was the period of Belisario Betancourt, where, if I'm not mistaken, the idea of peace is just to demobilize. Is that right?
No, what I do with my work, the purpose of this work is to relate the peace process with the political regime, which was the dismantle of the National Front. Because we are used to understand a peace process just as the peace process, like the negotiation table, like some actors from the team from the government, and then we have like the team from the FARC, and then what they negotiate and everything, and we don't see what is going on, like in the country, like in the political sphere, and. In order to understand those processes in the 80s, for me, it was very important to understand what was going on in the country in terms of the political elites. They wanted really to dismantle the National Front because at the time they thought that all those guerrillas, as you were saying, like eight groups, were the result of this lack of democracy in the political system. And so in order to demobilize all those guerrillas, they had to make this like a political opening, the apertura democratica, which meant to dismantle the National Front and to create a new constitution, which is like the 91 constitution. And so we had like a very different understanding of what meant to have to what was a peace process and a relationship with the political regime. And also Belisario Betancourt started talking about the objective causes of violence, which means understanding the structural reasons, like the objective reasons why some people decide to go to the guerrilla. It's not just, of course, there are like, you can be, let's say, obligado, forced.
Forced.
Of course, there are some people that are forced to go there, but there are some reasons also that explain why some people decide to join the guerrillas. Mm.
It is interesting. We need to jump around but those who are interested, please buy Sara's book, Colombia, una herida que no cierra. This will be obviously on all of our social media pages. But I wanted to ask you about current events right now as well, because obviously you are very active. You're very critical of the current government on Twitter or X, and since we've been in conversation, and since when this conversation goes out, well, Salvatore Mancuso, the famed and feared leader of the paramilitary groups from Cordoba, but who ran much of the northern Colombia, has finished his 15 days, 9 months, four, 15 years, 9 months, 4 days sentence, and is back in Colombia. And he's now going to be a gestor de paz. Now, you are an expert on peace accords. How do you feel about this guy being involved? All I can think of is that he has promised a lot of things to the government so that he can be included in the Jurisdicción Especial para la Paz and not admit to everything. This is all I can feel. But what do you feel about this?
Well, what I feel about this is that there are some actors of the conflict, the army, the guerrilla, and the paramilitaries. But an internal armed conflict is like those armies are related to the political elites, to civil society.
Yes.
Because of the recruitment process and everything, but also in the case of the paramilitaries, they were created by some political elites. Like they're not just, they were born just like because, spontaneous generation, but they were like financed, like people gave money. And people gave also knowledge and training and everything in order to create those groups. So what I'm thinking, because Mancuso gets here at the same time where the guerrilla commanders are not very satisfied with what the HEP is doing, right? And DLN also. We have to have like a social justice system different from the HEP. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what I see is that everything is related, and what they are like in a way pushing and trying to address is that the third parties that also are part of the conflict, they have to talk as well. And Mancuso has, like, we know the relationship with some enterprises and the paramilitaries, but we still don't know the names.
Yeah,
some of the names. So I think it would be interesting if this person, if Mancuso, tells the truth. And it doesn't have to be only Mancuso. It should be everybody.
Yeah.
All the people telling the truth, not just Mancuso. Mm-hmm. And in that case, I think from what he has said, I think he has a genuine will to tell things, and I think there should be new things, and I think other political actors also they start to talk because the Colombian armed conflict goes like very well beyond the paramilitaries, the guerrilla, and the army.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a. It's deep into society, and
yes.
I interviewed last year the Professor Jenny Pierce from London School of Economics, who's doing a book should come out this year about the elites in Colombia and so on, and it's fascinating. Well, the report was fascinating, and it goes a long way to explaining a lot of things. Again, as I said, Sara, I think I could listen to you and your experiences and your knowledge for hours, but unfortunately, we don't have more time.
The time.
But promise me that in the future that we will talk again and before your other book is out, because I know that you will continue to be a feature in sociological and political circles when we're discussing the Colombian peace accords and peace accords in general, but of course here in Colombia. So Sara Tufano, thank you so much for your time here on the Colombia Calling podcast.
Thank you so much, Richard, for inviting me and for listening to this story and for your questions and for your interest.
Well, you know, I live here. It's been a few years now, and it's something that somehow I'm going to have to start telling my older son, you know, who's 8, you know, okay. And I'm going to start. He asked me about, oh, are we in war? And I was like, well, let's start. But he's 8, and I know. But so everybody, please, you can find Sara's book in all good bookshops here in Bogota and around the country. Sara Tufano, that's Tufano, Colombia, una herida que no cierra. If you really want to get into the peace accords and the political situations in the 1980s in Colombia, so much of which is overlooked today, and you can start seeing patterns of errors taking place, get this book. I highly recommend it. And yes, I read it in 2 sittings. So there you go. Sara, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for your time, and I wish you all the best on your doctorate investigations there in Sao Paulo, because I know you're off next week.
Yes. No, thank you so much, Richard, for everything.
Okay. Well, this has been the Colombia Calling podcast. I've been Richard McCall talking to Sara Tufano. We'll be back next week with another interview and conversation with someone Colombia-related. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
The Colombia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. We are also sponsored by BNB Colombia Tours, which is a leading tour operator providing a wonderful range of exclusive small group shared tours for those over 50, along with customizable private tours to both popular and off-the-map destinations throughout this beautiful and diverse country. If you're interested in experiencing one of their unforgettable journeys through Colombia, be it a shared tour with like-minded travelers or creating a unique private package of your own, just complete the form on the Colombia Calling website, that's www.colombiacalling.co, or the BNB Colombia Tours website, that's www.bnbcolombia.com, and they'll be in touch within 24 hours to answer all of your questions and to start the planning of your exclusive Colombian adventure. So that's bnbcolombia.com and latinnews.com. Thank you for supporting our sponsors.
For the ones who get it done, the most important part is the one you need now. And the best partner is the one who can deliver. That's why millions of maintenance and repair pros trust Grainger, because we have professional-grade supplies for every industry, even hard-to-find products. And we have same-day pickup and next-day delivery on most orders. But most importantly, we have an unwavering commitment to help keep you up and running. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.